And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies,
the secret
oaths,
and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Parr. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. I'm Alan Park. These are Conspiracy Queries, and this is one of the mothers of conspiracy, the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, President of the United States, took place 50 years ago this month. And so for the next few episodes, Conspiracy Queries will be focusing on the death of John F. Kennedy. Some would say a great man. Others would disparage him and his accomplishments in his, 3 years of actually being the president. But I really don't think they should have killed him. He did a lot of things and wanted to do a lot of things that would anger many people and many well-placed people with access to powerful means of control, both structurally in the way of organizing events, as well as in the way of manipulating the minds of the viewer. And those are some tricks that were honed, shall we say, over the years. And I believe they are still using them and improving upon them, just as we are getting better and more efficient smartphones week to week, day to day. Our guest today is a former actor. He's a former governor. He was an American SEAL team member and for the U.S. Navy, a demolition team. You know who he is. And he's with us today on the line to talk about his new book, They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. Host of the former show Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. Jesse, why 63 things?
Well, we chose 63 both times because that was the year that President Kennedy was killed.
Okay.
1963. In this particular book, They Killed Our President, I probably could have put 163 reasons why. We parried it down to the 63 that we felt were the most dynamic that would prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald did not do it. Many people always question me on this, and the first question they ask you is, well, who did it, who did it, who did it? Well, that's difficult to state who did it because it's been 50 years and it's been covered up. But this book will unequivocally show you that Lee Harvey Oswald did not do it.
Right. Or the Lee Harvey Oswald that we're all led to believe did not do it in the way of, and I'm getting into doubles possibility now. Does your book go into that aspect at all?
Well, we go into all the aspects. Like I said, we give you 63. We take the position that if there had been a trial, you have to be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. And we basically give you 63 reasonable doubts. So I kind of laugh when I tell people, well, maybe we're wrong on one or two, but that means you still got 60 more to deal with.
Right. Hey, can I share with you something that turned me into the conspiracy person that I am?
Go ahead.
I was a little kid. I was watching television in a black and white television set in my basement. And there was some sort of JFK commemoration show. I think it was the 10th anniversary of his death. So this had been around 73, 74. And I'm a little kid. And I was fascinated by this, like nothing else other than cartoons could keep me fascinated. I just found it to be so interesting. Now, this was a mainstream, I don't know if it was CBS or NBC or whatever it was.
Sure.
But at the end of the show, they were telling us that this one lone guy was able to kill, as we are so often told, the most powerful man in the world. And you know what? As a little kid, I just didn't buy it. It didn't make sense to me. And it was a fait accompli in the program that, yes, this is what happened, and, you know, this is all official business, and I guess the Zapruder film wasn't even out yet, but it just didn't sit well with me. And so every time I went to my school library or if I could find anything in the TV guide about JFK, I would watch it. And I think that was my genesis of getting interested into basically the government lying to us.
Yeah, for me, I was actually alive when it happened. I was 12 years old in seventh grade in junior high. But I have an interesting footnote, much like you just said. When my mother passed away in 1995, for some reason, she had one of those big trunks that people used to keep, and they kept all, you know, stuff in it. And amazingly, at the bottom of the trunk, she kept every Minneapolis paper in pristine condition from that weekend. And she never, I didn't even know she had these. And my son and I were going through them, and we found these papers, and it was all that Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday editions of the Minneapolis paper. And we got to the Monday morning one. And this was a sub-headline in the Minneapolis Morning Edition, the Monday after Kennedy was killed on Friday and Oswald was killed Sunday at noon. So there weren't computers then, so this had to have gone out no later than late afternoon on Sunday for it to be in the Minneapolis Monday morning paper. And it was a sub-headline down on the bottom, and you know what it said? Dallas police declare case closed.
On Monday. The day
that
after...
had to go out right after Oswald was murdered.
Sure.
And well, they hadn't looked at one shred of evidence. They hadn't done any investigating at all. Lee Harvey Oswald never confessed to doing it. In fact, he vehemently denied it. And yet they declared the case closed Monday morning.
Well, maybe
you know
that
what, my son was 14 years old at the time. And you know what he actually turned to me and said to me?
What?
He turned to me, a 14-year-old boy, and he said, "Gee, Dad, they spend more time on a domestic."
Right.
I'll never forget when he said that to me, and I looked at him and I said, "Well, son, you're right."
Yeah, domestic, for anyone who doesn't know, is just when the police go to a home and there's an altercation and...
Yeah, and there's...
Investigation needs to be made.
It's spouses, and one of them's laying there dead.
Right. Unbelievable.
So you got a pretty good idea who the culprit was.
Well, I think there's a clue to why that might be, though, in your book. And this blew me off my seat because I don't consider myself a full scholar on the assassination, but I've certainly been in and around it for most of my life. And you pulled out the Katzenbach memo, which kicks off your book. And... that might have something to do with why the police said it was case closed. Can you tell us a little bit about the Katzenbach memo?
Well, that's actually number 64, because we don't even count that in the 63 that we give you. But I was so inclined to the Katzenbach memo that I told the publishers, we lead the book off with this. I want to lead the book off just with the Katzenbach memo, because to me it's not a smoking gun, it's a smoking cannon. And what it is, it's a memo from then-acting Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach to the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, on Monday morning. Now, again, the president was killed on Friday. His alleged assassin was killed on Monday morning. And in this memo, and I'll just paraphrase it down here, number one, here's what Katzenbach, of course, Bobby didn't come into work because his brother was dead.
Sure.
And so this is the acting U.S. attorney to the new president. And the memo states, number one, the public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he did not have Confederates who are still at large, and that the evidence was such that he would have been convicted had there been a trial. And then it finishes off a page and a half later. It goes, we need something to head off public speculation or congressional hearings of the wrong sort. I would like a definition of what a congressional hearing of the wrong sort is.
Exactly. And this this gentleman, Katzenbach, of course, prior to Kennedy's assassination, he was a little further down the food chain, I'm guessing.
Well, he was the assistant attorney general right underneath Robert Kennedy, who was the attorney general.
Oh, okay. So
and
then
he was now the acting attorney general because Robert, of course, his brother was killed Friday. He wasn't coming into work Monday.
Did we ever get a reaction from Robert regarding his underling's strange memo?
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea if Robert Kennedy even knew if this memo existed. I have no way of knowing.
Wow.
Yeah, but, I mean, this, see, people need to understand that two conspiracies took place that day, November the 22nd. The first conspiracy was the actual murder of our president. The second conspiracy was to cover it up afterwards. And this is not the smoking gun. This is the smoking cannon of the government cover-up. I mean, this is a document from them. How do they deny this?
Yeah. Have you ever...
Exactly what was said. They convinced the public Oswald was the lone nut killer, that he had no Confederates on the loose, and that he would have been convicted had there been a trial. And they headed off any, like I said, unwanted congressional investigations. I'm still trying to figure out, so the truth was unwanted.
Yeah, well, that often seems to be the case. Unfortunately,
truth is a bad word now. I'm truly amazed how they've morphed that into being a bad word. The word truth.
Shameful. Absolutely.
If you're called a truther today, that's a bad word.
Yeah.
And that's amazing to me how the truth can be morphed to mean something negative. How can the truth be bad?
Yeah, I saw a T-shirt the other day that said 2 + 2 = 4. We are the Mathers. So this memo, the Katzenbach memo, went to Bill Moyers, of course, who at the time eventually became a very famous broadcaster. And I'm curious, have you ever spoken with Bill Moyers about that memo?
No, I have not. I think the memo is self-explanatory. He was the acting, he was in communication of the new president, Lyndon Johnson, and on his staff.
Sure. I just wonder what his...
So it was just going through the chain of command. It would go to Moyer, but you can bet it went right to Johnson because Moyer is not going to have the authority to make any decision at that level, that when something of that magnitude would come across. It would be no different when I was governor had they sent it to my communication guy, who would have immediately then brought it to my attention.
All right. Jesse, tell us a couple of things. We're going to go into your book is wonderfully broken down into four sections, pretty much. And I wanted to ask you about the changing of the motorcade route through Dallas, through Dealey. This is all done by the Secret Service. They arrange for these routes, whatever is the best for the president. And in your book, you go into detail explaining how some people said it was actually Kennedy who altered the route and...
Well, what they did, they tried to blame the president, the dead guy, who couldn't respond for why standard operating procedures were violated that day. Even worse than changing the parade route or the motorcade route was the fact that they removed its standard operating procedure that Secret Service men ride on the bumper of the president's car. And we show where you can go on the internet. That's what I love about the book. Where it's available, people can read the book and go right to the internet and they can view it or hear it themselves. And they can draw their own conclusions. And this was astounding to me. This was a new one to me that I jumped at. Was that we actually have internet footage where you can see at Love Field where the Secret Service is being ordered off of the president's bumper by their senior agent. And you can see the Secret Service man throwing his arms out to his sides, palms in the air like, what's going on here?
Right.
And because that's standard. Why were they removed from the president's bumper? And they conveniently blamed the president for it. They said, oh, he wanted it that way. Well, we go into detail, and I can assure you, President Kennedy wouldn't have acted that way because he's a Navy man like me. And when you come from that background, you allow people to do their jobs. And the closest people to the president, like Kenny O'Donnell and that, said the president would never do that. He never interfered with how the Secret Service protected him. Never.
Yeah, that seems highly unlikely. But let me ask you,
that would be like me interfering with my protection as governor.
Right.
Of telling them, no, I don't want you riding with me in the car. I want you away from me in the next car.
But what kind of entity, what kind of governmental entity, and perhaps it's the Secret Service, can authorize such a change where even its own agents are, I've seen the clip you're talking about. He's throwing up his hands like, what do you mean I can't ride on the car?
Yeah, it's obviously. This is where I'm supposed to be. He knew his job, the young agent. And he was being ordered off the bumper by his superior, because that's how government works. You can't question a superior. It's very compartmentalized. I had a friend who was part of the Arms for Hostages in the middle 80s with the whole Reagan mess.
Right.
He was on the elite SEAL Team 6 before they were even known. And he didn't learn about it. He told me this. He said, I didn't know what happened until I saw it break on television. And then I thought, oh, my God, I was part of that. See, he was given a job to deliver something from point A to point B. He doesn't know the big picture. He only knows the job he's given. And that's how they're able to get away with things like this within the government, because it's so compartmentalized. The left hand never knows the big picture of what the right hand's doing, in other words.
We're with Jesse Ventura. He's got a new book out called They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. And as Jesse said earlier, there are probably 163 reasons, but, you know, there's only
well,
so
one
many.
One of the great ones I read today, Howard Weisberg was truly a remarkable man. He wrote the first book in 1965 called Whitewash on the Warren Commission.
Okay.
I'm reading it right now. He couldn't get this book published in 13 countries and was turned down by 113 publishers because it contradicted the Warren Commission with their own documents. What's amazing, I just read it verbatim in Howard's book, that the Warren Commission totally ignored the testimony of John and Nellie Connolly, the governor and his wife who were riding with Kennedy. Because right in their testimony, they state that they were not hit by the same bullet that hit Kennedy, which destroys the magic bullet theory and thus destroys the Warren Commission.
Yeah. Well,
and they chose to ignore it. How do you ignore a governor and his wife who were the two closest people to Jackie and Jack Kennedy?
That's a fascinating question, because there's obviously been so much control coming from systems that you say they're governmental and compartmentalized. But let me jump into the book here a little bit. And there were other assassination strictures already arranged in Florida and Chicago before Dallas.
Oh, yeah. They had already caught on that their attempts were to be made in three separate cities. They had it lined up where it would be in Florida, Chicago, or Dallas. And the only reason Chicago was the identical same scenario. They had a patsy. It was going to be a gunshot from a elevated building with Kennedy in the car. The whole thing was identical to Dallas, and that was found out by the first African-American Secret Service man. Oh, gosh, his name, Abraham, I forget his last name now, and he got thrown in prison years later, and a whole bunch of bad things happened to him. But, yeah, Kennedy was going to get it in one of those three, and Dallas just happened to be the last one where it worked.
And the Chicago one was earlier in 1963?
Yeah, it was like a month earlier. The only reason it failed was because Kennedy canceled the trip there, and there was an informant that informed the FBI of the danger, and guess what the informant's name was?
Do I have to?
Lee.
Really?
Yeah. And Lee Harvey Oswald happened to have an FBI informant number.
Okay, now that's interesting to me, because if he was to be killed, the President Kennedy was to be killed in Chicago, but it didn't happen, and you're saying it was a similar structure, then there were also similar motorcade changes that would have needed to have been done, as well as a patsy similar to Lee. I mean, someone had to pull some kind of trigger they were going to blame it on.
Oh, yeah. No, it was the same thing. We even tell you who the patsy was in Chicago that they had set up. He was a guy just like Oswald, a loner, former serviceman, considered mental problems.
So some of those folks, those trigger men, the Florida one and the Chicago one, the Lee Harvey Oswald equivalent, they may be people who don't even know that they might have died a few days later as well by a similar Jack Ruby type situation.
Absolutely. One of the great things that another thing the Warren Commission said, there was no connection whatsoever between Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald. Total lie. Talk to Judith Mary Baker. She was just in the country last week. I spent that day with her again. She was Oswald, for lack of better term, lover or mistress in New Orleans. She went to dinner with Oswald and Ruby. In fact, Ruby gave her $50 because she was short of money.
Oh, yeah, she has the book out.
Lee and Me.
Lee and Me, right.
Yeah, read that book and you'll fully understand that Ruby had known Oswald since Oswald was a child.
And that didn't come out in the Warren Commission.
No, the Warren Commission said the complete opposite. They said there was no connection whatsoever between Ruby and Oswald. And it isn't just Judith Baker. There's a half a dozen other witnesses who have stated unequivocally that they saw Lee Oswald with Jack Ruby on multiple occasions, even in Ruby's bar in Dallas.
How much of your information in your book came from the Warren Commission report? And before you answer that, I learned relatively recently, a few years ago, that the Warren Commission report is something like 26 huge volumes.
Yeah.
And then it's all distilled down to a single volume for people to read, the Reader's Digest version of what happened. And it's more about what's not in the Warren Commission report.
What the Warren Commission did more than anything was try to establish Oswald. They spent more time on establishing his background as being a communist sympathizer and all that to create the illusion that he did it. They spent more time doing that than they did to actually investigate the shooting. All they did, the Warren Commission, was rubber stamp the FBI's investigation.
Huh.
They wouldn't go anywhere else. If any leads led anywhere other than there, they simply ignored them.
All right. Well, in section 1 of your book, you have a lot of provocative headings and titles there. Let me ask you about Oswald couldn't have carried in the murder weapon.
Yeah.
That would sort of rule one out of performing the crime. But tell us a little bit about that section. Oswald couldn't have carried in the murder weapon.
Well, first of all, the only witness that saw Oswald come into the door of the book depository said he had nothing in his hands that morning. Second of all, they used the curtain. The Warren Commission said he had it cupped under his armpit and held it and said it was curtain rods. Well, if you look at the Mannlicher Carcano weapon, when you break it down, it has an unusually long wooden stock that can't be broke down. That's, I think, close to 34 inches long, nearly 3 feet, slightly under. Oswald was barely 5'9 or 5'10. I'm 6'4". I cannot cup that and put it under my armpit.
Right.
It would come up to about your ear. And so they want us to believe, and the people that rode him to work that day said his curtain rods were cupped in his hand and under his armpit when he walked with them. So that's the point. Oswald couldn't have carried the weapon that they said he carried into the book depository that morning because it just doesn't add up. The weapon, when you break it down, is far too long to be broke down to be carried from the palm of the hand to the armpit like they said he did.
Right. Are you clear on the difference between the Oswald that we all have come to know and love and his double and what the story is with that? I mean, here's a guy that went over to Russia, somehow knew how to speak Russian very well almost right away, but he was a low-level, supposedly a low-level operative within the military structure.
Right. Well, Oswald was involved in a false defector program, and in the world of espionage, it's very common for them to create two people with the same identity. And I think that some of that went on with Lee Oswald, that he had a second identity or a second person that was him also, because that gives people plausible denial in that world of espionage, if they can then say, well, no, I was here when actually they were there, and things of that nature. Oswald, it's already known we had a false defector program in the late 50s, and he obviously was part of it because he was stationed at a CIA base in Japan, and the military sent him for language training. Now, they don't do that with average grunts. Oswald was a Marine. Obviously, he worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence in some manner. You can see it in his military records and you can see just how, what he operated under and what he did. And so he was a low-level intelligence operator, in my opinion, that got sent to Russia as a false defector program, and then returned home with a Russian wife and all this stuff, and continued to work at some level. That's why they won't allow you to see his tax returns.
And as
now,
well,
how could Lee Oswald's tax returns affect national security?
Well, I guess you might be able to see who paid him what and for
exactly
what reason.
But that would have no effect on national security. What it would do, it would lead you to a paper trail of how was Lee Oswald earning a living. And if that paper trail led back to the U.S. government, doesn't that change the whole story?
Oh, absolutely.
There you go.
Absolutely. He was a patsy. So why did they frame a guy who'd already been to Russia and learn languages and sort of work for the military, and they also kept out of the final commission report that the repatriation loan for him to come back to the United States came from the government. So to me, that's not really a perfect patsy unless they're thinking
no,
but it
is when you control the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You got to follow that part of it.
Right.
You control it all. So therefore, he's a perfect patsy. They can portray him as a communist sympathizer. They can cast that, ooh, this could have been a communist or a Cuban plot to kill our president. And if we found that out, we'd go to war, wouldn't we?
Yeah, well, and possibly with the wrong country.
Well, they don't care.
No, obviously not.
War people want to go to war. They don't give a damn with who because there's money to be made.
Sure.
You know, and so, you know, Oswald was the perfect patsy because, number one, they controlled him. They controlled his movements. They could get him to do things like be the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans and go down and pass out pamphlets and have himself get arrested on purpose to set him up. He was set up perfectly. And you've got to have that in a coup d'etat. The public must be satisfied that the perpetrators have been caught in a coup d'etat, and you can never have a trial. So it all fit perfect for them to succeed. They then killed Oswald 2 days later. There was never a trial, and life went on.
Obviously, this is why it took so long for the Zapruder film to become public.
The Zapruder film would have never became public had it not been for Jim Garrison.
Right.
You would have never seen the Zapruder film ever. Time Life had it locked in their storage vaults. The only reason the Zapruder film came to light was Jim Garrison's trial in 1967, where he found out about it somehow and subpoenaed it.
As again, just to repeat what Jesse Ventura said earlier, that one of the great things about his book right now is that there are so many links, and it's almost like an interactive experience. So Jesse will describe something and then provide a YouTube link or what have you, and you can go to that, take a little time away from the book, and investigate the link for yourself.
How to determine that it is what it is, a big conspiracy, is always apply common sense. If it can't pass the smell test, the chances are you got what you got. And the point is this. If you break it down, if Lee Harvey Oswald is who they said he was, this disgruntled little Marine who became a Marxist communist, who got mad at Kennedy and shot and killed him for fame and fortune or whatever, like they portrayed him, why would anything have to be locked up in the National Archives because of national security?
In perpetuity, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? What could this guy know, this little Marine private, that would affect our national security to the point where they would have to lock up all these documents about him that we couldn't learn about until 75 years later?
Well, as your experience as a SEAL, a Navy SEAL, would put you in a much better position to know what national security really means. But to me, I'm very skeptical, and often to me, national security means somebody covering somebody's butt.
Oh, completely. They use it and abuse it. There are things for national security. There's no doubt about it. Certain things have to be held secret because of situations where people's lives could be in danger for whatever reason. But after time passes, everything should become public knowledge. And the reason I can say that is it's all done with our tax dollars, and we have every right to know what they're being spent on. And the point that it's being abused today, because anytime the government wants to cover up their wrongdoing, they simply lump it under national security, and we're not allowed to see anything.
I'm speaking with Jesse Ventura. It's quite a fascinating conversation. It is, they killed our president, 63 reasons to explain why that is the case. Jesse, you had a TV show, very enjoyable, Conspiracy Theory. And one of your conspiracy theory episodes was on the JFK assassination.
Yep.
How was that for you? Did you learn anything there, or were you just assembling facts you already knew?
No, I learned a lot doing that. In fact, that was one of the bargains I made with them. I said, look, if we get to a second season, my passion is JFK. I want to do JFK. And they said, absolutely. If we get to a second season, you can have an episode on JFK. And so we did. Oh, one of the big things I learned that day was talking to Mr. Newman. You're familiar with Mr. Newman and his wife. Everybody sees them on the Zapruder film. They're the couple who are covering their children right in front of the grassy knoll. They're laying across them to protect them.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Newman was physically the closest civilian to the fatal headshot.
Right.
He was the closest, other than the people in the car, Governor Connally and his wife and the Secret Service and the two Kennedys, Jack and John.
And he's covering his children, so he knows where the shot came from.
He knows, well, he was the closest person to see it. And here's the astounding thing. I looked at him and I said, well, what did the Warren Commission have to say about your testimony? And he looked at me and said, I was never called before the Warren Commission.
Really? No, yeah. So I don't know who he is either. I have no idea.
No, but I mean, how can the Warren Commission not call a guy who, I read his FBI report, how can they not call the closest living witness to the headshot and question him on what he saw?
Yeah. Well, again, covering somebody's butt, that's for sure.
Exactly. Again, and it's because Mr. Newman stated he felt the bullet came over his shoulder, which put it right at the grassy knoll. So therefore, they did not want to question him because it would take away from who they were going to blame. Any facts that led away from Oswald were ignored by the Warren Commission.
Such as the crowd that was relatively near the grassy knoll at the time of the shot, running towards what we've all come to know as the grassy knoll. Apparently, there were several of those people. You can see that in footage. And they didn't sit down for the commission either.
No, and it's worse than that. Again, we'll go back to Harold Weisberg and what he discovered in the Warren Commission's own fact-finding was when you listen to the tapes of the chief of police and the county sheriff who are riding one car in front of Kennedy, their first thing on their radios was ordering their men up to the grassy knoll.
To respond to what
to
somebody...
the shots they saw and heard.
Yeah, yeah.
They ordered their men to go to the triple bypass or the triple overpass, underpass, which is the grassy knoll.
And that's not in the Warren Commission report.
Well, it's in there, but they ignored it. It's in there because you get the testimony and you hear the actual, you can read the actual audio tapes of these two law enforcement guys right after the shooting happened, ordering their police what to do.
Right.
They were ordered to the grassy knoll. They were not ordered to the book depository.
So that's in the Warren Commission, the larger compendium of books that from which they distill down into the single copy that everybody
has.
Yeah,
it's in their own documents.
Unbelievable.
That's what Harold Weisberg, because Harold was phenomenal.
Now,
Went off all the Warren Commission's own documents, and it's unbelievable, his books. And he wrote his first one in 65 and could not get a publisher to publish it.
I know we've gone over this many, many times. When I say we, I mean people looking into this particular aspect I want to ask you about, but it's really important. It's 50 years on. We still don't know the full story, or I don't. Maybe you do.
No, I don't either. But trust me, I don't either.
Let's spend a little time on the gun that can't really do all that in the amount of time given.
Well, I couldn't do the shooting. And plus, they discovered that the sight was off. They had to put two shins in, little metal strips,
right,
to get the telescopic sight on target. It would shoot straight, but you had to shoot low and to the left, I think. Now, what marksman can take a weapon and not have it targeted?
With a moving target.
Well, and yeah. Not have it sighted in.
Yeah.
You know, they had to put two shins in it to get it to be sighted in properly. And not only if you don't believe I couldn't make the shots, we cover this in the book. There's a gentleman named Carlos Hathcock. He's legendary in the Marine Corps. He's considered the greatest sniper in history. He was the chief instructor at Quantico, the Marine Sniper School. He attempted 10 times to duplicate Oswald's shooting and could not do it.
Huh.
And you got to read his quotes. Because remember this, when you go into the military, they're not stupid. They give you batteries of tests. They want to know where they can use you to the best of your abilities and be successful. Well, Oswald was not 0300 infantry. Oswald was a radar technician. In other words, he was a pencil pusher. And I don't say that with bad connotation. Carlos Hathcock was a Marine Corps sniper who carried a weapon his entire time in the Marine Corps. Oswald probably never carried a weapon hardly after boot camp, unless he was standing watch. And you're going to tell me that this Marine radar technician could outshoot the greatest sniper in Marine Corps history?
Yeah, it seems a bit unlikely.
You know, use common sense here and just apply common logic. That's not logical. And that's you wait till you read in the book Carlos's quotes about it when he couldn't do it, and they said Oswald did it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
In other words, Carlos ain't buying it.
Right. Oswald was an incredibly lucky man to be able to make those shots. But it's just not possible in the amount of time with that kind of gun. That's case closed.
I tried to do it, and the fastest I could rotate and not even get on target was about 7.5 seconds. I mean, and the first shot he missed with, the first shot would be your best shot.
Right.
And yet you got to recycle it and get back on target twice. I couldn't do it, and I tried, I think, 7 times, and I scored like 1 or 2 hits out of the 7. Other than shooting, when I shot at the first one, I told everybody I'm going to hit with the first shot. I did that. I could do that no problem at all, hit with the first shot. And I wasn't shooting at a moving target.
Yeah, it's reloading and getting the second and third.
And they said the first shot missed. So you had to reload, recycle it, get a new round into the chamber, get back on sight, fire it, do it again a third time, and the third was the best shot. That was the fatal headshot.
Now, Oswald denied, and I would have done the same thing, shooting the president. But in your book, you have a chapter on modern voice technologies determining that he was telling the truth. So this is like a postpartum lie detector test.
Yeah, this is a technique, and in fact, they use this voice. They say it's allowed in court, and they say it's far more accurate than a lie detector. That's what the experts say, and it's using your voice stress test. And they've taken the technology we have today, which of course they didn't have back in '63, but they've taken the technology we have today, and they've played Oswald's voice when he said, "I didn't shoot anybody," and everything that they have audio, and overwhelmingly it comes back that he's telling the truth.
I think we should apply that technology retroactively to whatever Alan Dulles said at the Warren Commission and see if he's telling the truth, because I highly doubt it.
I wish we could use that technology on Dick Cheney and George Bush about the Iraq War.
Yeah. That's another, I mean, this is the thing. They
find out if they were telling us the truth.
Yeah, I wanted to get to this because this Kennedy assassination, I mean, first of all, there were so many different motives for people to want to kill him. You've got people saying it was the mob, it was the CIA, it was the FBI, it was the Secret Service, it was the Jesuits.
You had a half a dozen entities that all very well could have wanted Kennedy dead.
And I'm sure some of the entities that wanted him dead that didn't have to do anything were quite thrilled about it.
Well, and if they teamed up together, imagine how powerful they'd be then.
Well, that's my question. You've jumped on it. It is to be able to pull something off and to have the same plan afoot in Florida and in Chicago. It's amazing to me that this would still be able to happen and that the machine just moves forward. Well, and subsequently, what happens? We go into Vietnam and spend an unbelievable amount of time and death in there.
One of the big things you'll hear from the naysayers is if it was a conspiracy, someone would have talked, right?
Well, people have been talking for 50 years.
Exactly. People have been talking for 50 years. It's just mainstream media hasn't reported it.
Yeah, it's who's listening.
I found astounding Johnson's, what's her name, Brown, his mistress.
Okay.
Where she talked about the meeting the day before Kennedy was killed at Murchison, the oil guy, with Hunt, the oil guy. J. Edgar Hoover, Nixon, and LBJ were all there, and LBJ came out of the meeting and grabbed her hand. His face was flushed, and he was all red. And with gritted teeth, he said, "After tomorrow, those Kennedy boys will never embarrass me again."
Wow.
Now, do you believe her or not? I don't know. But she said it, and she had nothing to gain by stating her recollection of that this happened.
Yeah, you always have to look at who benefits. Absolutely.
Oh, if you look at who benefited, it comes to LBJ. Because he was dead in the water. He was neck deep in the Billy Saul Estes and Bobby Baker scandals in Texas. There was a belief he could well have gone to prison. And then November 22nd happened. He became the president and all that stuff went away.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm trying to understand is like with a machine that's big enough to put this together. And you mentioned George Bush and Dick Cheney being tried. I saw George Bush's well-wishing to the troops on Memorial Day the other day. I just about tossed up my breakfast. But how are we doing in the way of tragedy strikes in the way of Kennedy, and then history takes a different course, and that obviously did happen on 9/11 as well, where you've got this massive crime and a country that's so fascinated with CSI shows and SVU shows, and they always want to get the details of everything that happened. And then the biggest crime, seemingly, or one of them, arguably, ever to take place on soil, and they're okay with wrapping that up in a day, blaming it on somebody and going off to war in a country where the assassins or the killers weren't even supposed to be from.
Exactly. It you know, they're called false flag operations. They've been going on for years. I was teaching at Harvard when McNamara came through and admitted the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't occur, which was the false flag operation that got us into the Vietnam War. 58,000 of my generation died, and probably over 1 million Vietnamese died over an event that never occurred. False flag operations have been going on since time began, and they're done to get the public behind a war. They have to do things to make the public want to go to war, so they create these things that happen to send us to war, and we accept them because we take them on face value, and we all have this belief that somehow our government won't lie to us, and we need to understand something. Government is made up of people, and bad people can come to power. If you don't believe me, go talk to the Germans.
Yeah.
They can tell you about bad people coming into power in the 30s. And people need to realize that's all government are people. And evil people can become powerful.
Well, I think powerful people, I think a lot of people are possibly even psychotic who manage to find the backing and the support and the seeming, you know, normalcy to rise to a position where evil, wicked people may be the small percentage of society, but they seem to be the very large percentage of running society.
They very well could be, because and people often say to me that why is the Kennedy murder important today, because the world would be completely different today had Kennedy lived. That utmost. And the other reason it's important is this, and remember, I can't rightly tell you who they are when I say this, but let me say it. If they can murder the president and get away with it, what can't they do?
Absolutely. They killed his brother.
That's why it's still important today. How can they get away with this 50 years later?
And they killed his brother. And what are your thoughts on John F. Kennedy Jr.?
Well, I haven't really gone into it, but I will say this. Take a look at all the political assassinations in the United States, and they all are against men of peace. Men who stood for peace and had millions of people that believed in them and believed in the peace that they were talking about. John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Dr. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, when he returned from Mecca, was a changed man, and John Lennon.
Right.
They all were men who advocated peace, and they all died violently from a gun. Isn't that ironic?
It is ironic, but it's also very. I was immediately skeptical when John F. Kennedy Jr. died, because I mean, how many deaths like that in a family can you be if without tempting the odds? But I had heard.
Well,
I mean, he had that
conspiracy theory that didn't come complete was Teddy was supposed to die at Chappaquiddick.
All right, but only Mary Jo Kopechne did.
Right, but would that kill him anyway politically?
Sure.
He could never go for president then, so in essence, if that was some conspiracy to that, there you've got every Kennedy brother eliminated.
Right.
Was now, we're supposed to believe, I guess, that that's just happenstance.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's just the lucky
we're
ball.
We're supposed to sit back and we're going to go, you know, those Kennedys sure got bad luck.
And the same people that believe that think it's crazy to have a conspiracy theory like a Kennedy getting killed in Dealey or a 9/11.
Yeah.
But they'll believe that kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
Now, I always thought with John, John Jr., he was very popular. He was one of the more, I guess, better looking Kennedys.
He was scary.
He had a magazine.
He was scary because he gave that speech at the Democratic Convention and propelled himself. He could have gone anywhere politically.
Yeah, he could have been. And then it was George Bush and Al Gore after that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunate. That was a very sad day as well. It's been a very difficult time for everyone who realizes this. That's the thing. I mean, when you talk about false flags and the Gulf of Tonkin being a false flag incident to flare up interest into Vietnam, and even before that with the Operation Northwoods plan that Kennedy said no to, do they teach in schools or university the concept of a false flag, or is that something you just have to come about on your own?
I don't think that's taught in our main curriculum. It's just like I've maintained. Do you know the book by Smedley Butler called War is a Racket?
Absolutely.
Well, I've advocated that should be mandatory reading for every high school senior in America.
And they say, who's Smedley Butler? I have no idea.
They don't even get taught about who Smedley Butler was, General Butler. And yet his book should be mandatory reading to graduate from high school, in my opinion, to where you finally get a man who won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, not 1, 2, who tells you that war is a racket. And that you don't necessarily, you know, when the war is wrong. Now, remember, the military, the men who fight in the war, they're victims, too.
Absolutely.
Because they have no choice. They have to do what they're told to do. But when a war is wrong to begin with, how can you claim that there can be heroes in it?
Absolutely. It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
If the war is wrong to begin with.
Yeah. It's based on a lie.
Yeah, if the war is based on a lie, how can you then equate that there are heroes in it?
Well, they do it all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you going to be back on the air with a television show? What happened to your show?
It was done after 3 seasons. They didn't renew it for a 4th. And, you know, in all, I was pretty well burnt on it, too. I was ready to move on. I mean, we did 24 episodes. 23 of the 24 they aired, which was amazing. I won a Stony Award from High Times Magazine, a Lifetime Achievement Award. They gave it to me because they said anyone that could get this show on TV deserved a Lifetime Achievement Award. But I've moved on. I now will have an internet show. We're ramping it up right now. I'll be doing it from Mexico into the United States on Aura.tv, the same company that owns, that Larry King works for. I will be working for them, so I will be doing an internet show back into the United States from Mexico, and believe me, it'll be a show that I'll have freedom to speak freely because I'll be outside the country going in. It's kind of like broadcasting to East Berlin.
Right. Pirate radio kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay. And when can we look forward to seeing that?
I would hope right after the turn of the new year.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I would hope we will be up and running. I'm waiting with bated breath because we're going to do it from Mexico and here.
Hey, there have been a lot of rumors going around that you are considering a run for president next time around, but I'm not going to ask you if you are or if you aren't. I'm going to ask you that... if you were to run, you have a lot of ideas and a lot of frankness that goes against the grain, similar to John F. Kennedy. You disagree with a lot of the monetary aspects of the economy. You've spoken out much on the establishment on this show and many others. And my question to you is, were you to be in a position to become the president of the United States— are you in any way concerned about your own life? The machine that took out Kennedy is still around. The 9/11 machine is still around. What chance do you have of surviving a four-year term were you to be sworn in?
Well, that's a pretty powerful question, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much.
No, I mean, think about it. I don't know. Would I be in fear for my life? Absolutely. Because, again, if they can kill the president and get away with it, what can't they do?
Yeah.
And so certainly I would be aware of that fact because I would be a rogue. But my belief is they would never let me get even that far.
Well, it happened to Ron Paul. I mean, I'm not here to endorse anyone politically,
right.
But I will say that Ron Paul, while he was running, even the first time Obama got in, during his campaign there in 2007 and 8, Ron Paul was saying things that are in the Constitution, that are sworn into the fabric and the structure of the country as it was built.
Yep.
And advocating things that are Republican ideals. And he was portrayed as an absolute idiot.
Yep.
Like a complete moron.
Yep.
And they would have him on different shows almost as an entertainment factor. I was like, if this guy is so spot on with the tenets of your philosophy, how can you also portray him as a nutcase?
Because he wasn't the chosen one.
Right. So you fear something like that might happen to you if you got...
See, Ron Paul's problem was he stayed with the Republican Party. It was a smart move because it gave him airtime, which he'd have never got. But when he didn't get their nomination, he should have then broken free of them and ran as an independent.
Right.
And I even stated I'd run with him. I said if Dr. Paul would quit the Republican Party, I would run with him as an independent. Why he didn't quit the Republicans, I'll never know. I don't know.
Well, he's got a new venture now.
He was a remarkable guy. He was the only guy out there I trusted, although there is a second person to trust now out there.
Who is that?
Angus King of Maine.
Okay.
He's the former independent governor of Maine. We were the two independent governors at the same time, only I got all the press.
Right.
But Angus was there 8 years as the independent governor of Maine. He is now the independent senator elected as an independent from Maine. He would be, if I didn't use Howard Stern, if I could use Howard's show, I would love to have Angus run with me.
Well, that's a maybe, everybody. I didn't even ask you if you were going to run, and
well,
now I got a solid maybe.
I'm just throwing out who I would choose.
Sure, sure.
Who I want to align myself. Angus King of Maine would be number one on the list.
I'm going to throw you a curveball right before we sign off. First of all, I want to remind everybody that Jesse Ventura, with his amazing new book, I've been through about a third of it and skimmed through the rest of it. It's called They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. He will be signing that book, Jesse will, at the Barnes & Noble in St. Cloud, Minnesota at 7 p.m. That's on November 22nd. Should be a pretty interesting day. Just before I let you go, what are your thoughts on the assassination of JFK and the whereabouts of George Bush Sr. on that day?
Well, you know, I never paid any attention to George Bush Sr., but apparently he's one of the people that can't tell you where he was.
Couldn't remember. Yeah.
Which is a rarity, because I remember distinctly I was in seventh grade and we were sent home from school that day.
Sure.
And then there's that photograph that's appeared out in front of Dealey Plaza, where if that's not George Bush Sr., it's his twin.
Well, it would be pretty amazing to be in Dallas.
So like him, if it's not, it's his twin double.
Yeah.
And the fact that Bush tried to provide himself with an alibi later that day. I learned all this stuff I didn't know any of it until I spoke with Russ Baker.
Right, Russ Baker from...
who did that great book exposing the Bush family.
Russ Baker has a website, Who, What, Why, and there's a fantastic article on there. Bush and the JFK Hit, Part 9.
Oh, yeah, and Russ was the one that made me aware of it. I didn't know anything about, you know, I knew Bush was at the Bay of Pigs because it was his two ships that were there.
Yeah.
You know, from Zapata Oil, so he was neck deep in the Bay of Pigs invasion. But I never knew about Dealey until I spoke with Russ Baker, and that was a thing on my TV, and in fact, that happened on my TV show. So there was another big one that hit me between the eyes on my TV show, not just with Mr. Newman not being called in front of the Warren Commission, but also the fact if there could have been George Bush Sr. involvement.
Well, they do lie. I can't imagine being in New York City when John Lennon was killed and going, was I in New York that day?
Yeah.
I can't really remember.
I don't even remember quite where I was.
Well, you know? Jesse, the Body Ventura, I wish you all the best in your new venture of broadcasting from Mexico. I will definitely want to be aware of when that comes on. Thank you for spending time with us today. It's a very sad reason to do so, but I hope people buy your book and learn some things. It's a very entertaining book with a fast read, and you've been great.
Thank you, and I appreciate you allowing me on because, like I said, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, and MSNBC won't have me on, and I can only determine it's because of the content of the book that they told the line, and it shows you that we need to fight for all the free media we can get because we're certainly not getting it.
Well, that is one of the reasons I wanted you on. I couldn't believe they didn't want to have you on, and then immediately I corrected myself and went, no, of course they don't want to have him on.
Yep,
they had you on with your other book and lots of other reasons, but not about this.
Yep, not about this. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll do it again sometime.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.